Jewish mysticism nowadays. In the very first lecture, I outlined the four basic phases of Jewish history, which provide a framework for understanding all things dealing with Jewish tradition and culture. The originary ancient Near Eastern biblical phase, the Greco-Roman rabbinic Talmudic phase, both of which provided the raw materials for what was to become medieval Judaism in all of its splendorous multiplicity and divergence. Third phase, medieval Judaism, in which Jews lived a diasporan existence that began so well and ended so catastrophically in the 15th and in the 16th centuries. The age of the ghettos, the age of the Jewish isolation from general society, the 16th through the 18th centuries, when Lurianic ideas permeated the Jewish mind as it was closed off from the general world. And then the fourth and final period, the modern period, marked sociopolitically by the emergence of the Jew out of the ghetto into emancipation, into full equal citizenship, at least by law, if not in actuality, in the modern nation states of America and Europe. In the modern period, as the Jews were emancipating themselves from their past and forging new paths in history, all things were reevaluated, all things were changed, circumstances called for exactly that kind of rereading, refining, getting rid of, creating new forms of Jewish existence. One of the things that was most enthusiastically dumped over the side as baggage which was no longer of any use to Jews who wanted to westernize themselves and modernize themselves, to leave the world of the ghetto behind, was the glorious tradition of Jewish mysticism. Jews who were modernizing and westernizing were adopting the values of a scientific, rational, enlightenment understanding of life, the world, and how human beings should live. A barrier and an impediment, an embarrassment, perhaps even greater than the embarrassment of speaking European languages or English, with foreign accents, wearing foreign clothes, would be the baggage of the Jewish mystical tradition, which didn't sit well in 19th century scientific enlightened circles. As the Jews fought for equal civil rights, trying to prove that they were as good as the best people in Europe, one of the things that had to go was the embarrassment of the Jewish mystical tradition. It was repudiated and rejected by the Jews, by and large, who were entering Western society. As a typical example of the assimilating, westernizing, modernizing Jews who found the mystical tradition an embarrassment, skeletons in the closet to be locked away for its ideas, perhaps for the travesty of the Sabbatean movement that had led to such nihilistic, antinomian results, whatever the reason was, the mystical tradition was an embarrassment and needed to be done in. The great German Jewish historian Heinrich Gratz, who wrote a multi-volume history of the Jews between 1891 and 1898, of course needed to address the issues of Jewish mysticism and its place in Jewish history. A few passages from Gratz's History of the Jews will indicate, I think, very dramatically what the basic attitude of Western Jews was to the Kabbalistic tradition. Gratz writes, for example, that the Kabbalistic ideas that began insinuating themselves into the general life of the Jews was a false doctrine, which, although new, styled itself a primitive inspiration, although un-Jewish, called itself a genuine teaching of Israel, and although springing from error, entitled itself the only truth. Discord was the mother of this monstrosity. Jewish mysticism is a monstrosity, which has ever been the cause of schism, causing breaks in the Jewish community. As soon as this secret lore steps out of its obscurity into the light of the sun, it shows its nakedness and deformity. So much for the Kabbalah. Close thinking is no concern of the Kabbalah. It is satisfied with fantastic pictures and symbols, however unsubstantial. This occult science, which made its appearance with a flourish, rests on deception, at best on the self-deception of its founders. Its theory is not old, as it pretended, but it's something very modern. The Kabbalah is, according to Grantz, a grotesque distortion of Jewish and philosophic ideas. In order to make it appear ancient and authentic, the compilers had recourse to fraud. That's extraordinarily strong language. False doctrine, un-Jewish, error, monstrosity, nakedness, deformity, fantastic pictures and symbols, self-deception, pretense, grotesque distortion. Or from a later volume, speaking about the Jewish mystics that we've been reviewing in these lectures. These Kabbalists obscured the mental light with which men of intellect, the philosophers from Sadia to Maimonides, had illumined Judaism and substituted for a refined religious belief fantastic and even blasphemous chimeras. The intellectual degradation of the Jews in the following centuries is to a large extent their work. According to Grantz, the mental and intellectual inferiority of the Jews is due entirely to their preoccupation with mysticism. The mystics led astray both their own times and posterity through designed or unintentional imposition, and the injuries which they inflicted on Judaism are felt even at the present day. Abraham Abulafia composed at least 22 so-called prophetic books, but they were the product of a diseased mind, which was later used by other Kabbalists. The Zohar confirmed and propagated gloomy superstition and strengthened in people's minds the belief in the kingdom of Satan, in evil spirits and ghosts. Through its constant use of coarse expressions, often verging on the sensual, and here you can see the Victorian, here the Victorian Gratz, repelled by anything smacking of the body, of the sensual, those metaphors and poems that the Zohar said so luxuriated in, to Mr. Gratz and his compatriots, an embarrassment, the sensual. In contradistinction to the chaste, pure spirit pervading Jewish literature, the Zohar sowed the seeds of unclean desires and later on produced the sect that laid aside all regard for decency, his not-so-clouded allusion to the Sabbateans and the Hasidim. Finally, the Zohar blunted the sense for the simple and the true and created a visionary world in which the souls of those who zealously occupy themselves with it were lulled into a kind of half-sleep and lost the faculty of distinguishing between right and wrong. A few more lines of Grantz, and I think we'll get pretty well in hand the attitude of 19th century, westernizing, assimilating Jews to the tradition and heritage of the Kabbalah. During the last three decades of the 16th century, the Kabbalah gained soul mastery in Palestine. It conjured up apparitions and encouraged orgies of mysticism. It was a period of Kabbalistic mania, coincident with profligacy and moral degradation, and its victims despised not only the sciences, but even the Talmud with its exhortations to sobriety. In the Judaism invented by Gratz and his compatriots, Judaism was a sober, moral, scientifically aligned, rational, pure, chaste tradition, everything that the Kabbalah opposed. Then, for the first time, the Jewish world entered on a dark age of its own with all the appropriate credulity. The harm that the Kabbalistic doctrines of Luria caused in Jewish circles is inexpressible. Judaism has not even yet succeeded in entirely freeing itself from the Lurianic mania. That's sort of what we would have heard had these lectures been recorded at the end of the 19th century by someone like Gratz, for whom Judaism was to be aligned with and made identical with morality, enlightenment, rationality, sobriety, with the world of mind rather than the world of imagination. But here we are 100 years later than Gratz, and Jewish history has undergone some changes, and this attitude of repudiation and embarrassment of the Kabbalah has undergone some profound changes. What was an embarrassment to 19th century enlightened, progressive, liberal Jews has become the 20th century's pride. Kabbalah has been recovered and restored and looked at with a very different set of lenses than the ones used by Gratz and the 19th century Jews, who were embarrassed by Kabbalah, who suppressed it and did everything that they could to separate it from Jewish history and an understanding of Jewish culture and religion. Gershom Scholem, the one whose books we read so much in courses like these and in others connected with Jewish mysticism, was someone who rewrote the pages of Jewish history, rewrote it in the sense that what Gratz had repudiated as secondary and as dangerous to the Jewish tradition, Scholem restored to its rightful place. Scholem and his disciples argued that you can't detach Jewish mysticism from the body of Judaism and pretend to have understood it. Some people claim that Scholem made gargantuan claims on behalf of the Kabbalah, that it was the true source of Jewish spiritual creativity. That's a point to be debated by scholars. Myself, I'm not convinced that Scholem ever attributed to the Kabbalah the entire source of Judaism's ability to survive and to create all sorts of ideas. But Scholem and his disciples are surely right in saying that without an understanding of Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah, we would really not have any understanding of Judaism at all. It would be a one-sided Gratzian view, aligning Judaism with the life of mind and sciences, forgetting how much Judaism had done to cultivate the imagination and how responsive to Jewish history the Kabbalists had been. They were the ones who transformed the Kabbalah for their own day, and without understanding their efforts, we lose totally the ability to understand the spiritual and creative resources of the Jewish people throughout their ages. And so, for those who want to recover a more equal, well-balanced, full view of Jewish creativity and understand Jewish responses to history, 20th century historians have rewritten our understanding and changed our notion of what it is to write Jewish history. Historians have been the ones who have reversed Gratz's historical distortions. There's another set of interests which have led people to rediscover the Kabbalah, not restricted to the writing of Jewish scholarship and Jewish history as in the case of Scholem, but historians of modern science have also revised our picture of where modern science emerges. In the good old mythic days, science emerged somewhat immaculately from the heads of rationally inclined empirical positivists who did away with their religious superstitions and beliefs and who, by a disinterested view of the natural world, sticking close to the empirical evidence of their experiments, made breakthrough after breakthrough, removing science farther and farther from the realm of imagination and religion, or what the moderns would have understood as superstition. Much of this writing of the history of modern science has been revised as scholars have discovered more and more and more how some of the 17th century scientists, the 18th and the 19th and even the 20th century science have taken their inspiration and their goals and even some of their methods and terminology from the world of the occult sciences, how deeply enmeshed they were in mystical categories of thinking. Oh, if for no other reason than the notion of the uniformity of all reality, that underlying everything there is an order and a structure. Those were the sorts of ideas that the Kabbalists and other mystics entertained long before science was able to verify that in its own terms. The inspiration which leads scientists and intellectuals and philosophers today to search for some sort of underlying, overarching structure, deep structure, that links things together wherever they are in one order of life, is something which the Kabbalah and its notions of infinity and process anticipated. The more we understand the interest in Kabbalah and the interest in mysticism in general, in what among Western intellectuals, their dabbling in the occult sciences and alchemy and astrology and divinology and chiromancy and all of the others, the better able we'll be able to understand how it was that science in the West, in modernity, emerged in the way that it did. And so 20th century historians and philosophers of science have once again called our attention to what can be learned from the mystical tradition, a far cry from Mr. Gratz's view that science and mysticism are obviously juxtaposed and antagonist to one another. There is a third source of interest, modern interest, which have led people back to studying Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, and mysticism in general. And that is in the realm of art. And here I think that the examples move back and forth. Something about modern developments in art have taught us at the end of the 20th century to look at the mystical tradition somewhat more freshly, with somewhat less bias than given to us by Gratz and our rationalist ancestors. What we learn from modern art is what happens when the camera and the photograph began competing with the canvas for depictions of reality. In the old days before we had cameras and all of our other optical devices, it was easy to think that the goal of art was to capture a relatively literal representation of reality. It would be our only way of recording what things looked like. And so the goal of art was to imitate, and the better art was the art which caught reality more accurately. And then came all of those revolutionary movements in technology, which brought the camera along. And with the camera, several things happened. One, you no longer needed to be much gifted or spend many years in a conservatory learning how to capture reality on a piece of paper. The camera allowed one to do that as soon as you put it into your hand, point and click. What the photograph did was to give people a technology for capturing imitations, fairly literal, representative ones of what's out there. That wasn't the end of art. What the photograph did was to free art to begin exploring other sorts of things. If artists no longer had to capture and imitate accurately what was out there, they could explore more fundamental, more deep, more significant things, like what is the very nature of perception itself? What is the reality out there? It's not exactly as we see it. There are shapes and colors, non-representational art, and art began to develop more and more an experimental attempt to depict processes and fundamental things which art perhaps wasn't free to do before the camera. It taught us that reality is more complex and that the modes of perception are more complex than we would have thought. Art could look at the world and depict it non-representationally, paradoxically perhaps bringing us closer to the truth of how we operate and what's out there than any accurate painting ever could have done. And then, once art began to show us its abstract, non-representational, perhaps even metaphysical investigations into colors and lines and shapes, the fundamental building blocks of our experience, we were able to look at photographs with new eyes. Instead of reading them merely as accurate documents of what's out there, we began to appreciate how they, too, play with color, light, shadow, explorations of how what our eye sees and processes are put together into accurate pictures of things which don't really exist out there. There's a reciprocal relationship. Now, I think this being involved in modern art and understanding how the photograph changes our notions of what it means to represent reality made it a little bit easier for us to understand what the Midrash did to the Bible. The Midrash, in rereading it, and the German Hasidim in deconstructing it, and Abraham Abulafia's techniques, in some ways, are non-representational ways of representing what the texts of the Bible are, what the external world is, and how our perceptions construct it. In some ways, I think there's an interesting parallel between the developments in abstract art and the techniques for reading and observation which the mystics developed. And if the mystics themselves are opaque and hard to get to, the more familiar we are with the modern developments in modern art, the more able we are to understand how they worked. And the deeper we are into our interests in understanding the fundamental experience of sensation, and the more we begin understanding how it's our imagination and our mind which constructs reality, the more we begin to understand what the mystics were after too, giving us non-representational, deconstructive techniques for refreshing the way we observe, for dehabituating our normal everyday activities. As art goes more and more abstract, some artists find more and more inspiration in the Kabbalistic tradition and in mysticism in general. Galleries and art books are filled with Jewish artists and other artists who are experimenting on canvas and in stone with forms that embody the ideas taken from Jewish mysticism. And therefore, I think we have another source of 20th century renewed interest, positive interest, in what the Kabbalah has to teach. Experimentations in colors, lines, and channels, attempts to depict the ideas of the Kabbalah, inspire art and help train our eyes in order to understand the art and our ancient literature. So that's a third source of deep inspiration for why people would turn to the Jewish mystical tradition. There's a fourth sign of renewed interest. Reform liberal Judaism, which had emerged in 19th century Germany and which had flourished in America, pretty much adhere to some of the ideals that Mr. Gratz had laid out for us, that Judaism is to be identical with an ethical system of life, that it doesn't teach anything which is contrary or different to science, and that it's a sober, down-to-earth, moral path. Well, that's what liberal westernizing religion wanted to do. It tried to transform religion and its powerful experiences and the dimensions of imagination, eliminate all of that from religion, and create something called civil religion, asking us all merely to be good. That's ethics, but it's not religion. And in the middle of the 20th century, and in the final third, if one were to take a look at the Reform prayer book, and to take a look at its readings, in order to get people into the proper mood for religious experience, one would find them not quoting the treatises on ethics, but page after page of quotation of Hasidic masters. What the 19th century found as an embarrassment, the 20th century, in search of rich, imaginative religious life, finds in the Jewish mystical tradition and in one of its offspring, Kabbalah. I know of no more profound, telling example of the transformation in attitudes from the 19th century, as we saw in Gratz, to 20th century renewed interest in Kabbalah than in the new editions of the prayer books used by Reform Jews. There is another, more social, more political, more human aspect to a renewed interest in discovering what Kabbalah has to teach about Judaism and about human life. And I have in mind in specific the revolutionary movement of the feminists in general and the Jewish feminists in particular. As with all feminists, suffering from a sense of exclusion by the patriarchy for the dominance of masculine imagery and notions of what God is and what religious life should be, as represented in the mainstream of the Jewish tradition, Jewish feminists who are trying to find a Jewish way of affirming their femininity and of being included in the body politic of the Jewish community turn to the Kabbalah and use that as authoritative evidence that Judaism was not always as dominantly masculine and patriarchal as the 19th century would have us believe. By delving into the great symbolism of the Shekhinah, of the feminine within God, the feminists seem to find a precedent to support their claims that Judaism is more than what the old traditions taught, that the Kabbalah contains secrets and inspiration and precedent for dignifying the status of women in the modern world. After all, I think the argument goes, if feminine imagery and feminine parables and feminine structures can be used in Kabbalistic thinking, if it's good enough for the Kabbalists in trying to be fair to reality, then it ought to be good enough for the Jewish community too. It's not just God, blessed be He, in the Jewish tradition. The Jewish feminists remind us that it's also the Holy One, blessed be she, that the feminine is as much a part of the cosmic reality as is the masculine. And living in accordance with these cosmic patterns, the feminists claim that it's Jewish mysticism that lays a path for our regeneration of a more equitable, egalitarian Jewish life. So, we have one group after the other bringing renewed interest, their own agenda, to the Kabbalah and discovering that there's something to be found there. Unlike Gratz's embarrassment, something positive, inspiring, an inspiration. We have rewritten Jewish history. We're rewriting the history of science. We're discovering new affinities and ways of access to the difficulties of modern art. We're finding that even our most liberal, progressive, ethicizing religious traditions are turning to the Kabbalah to inspire and fire human imagination and religious experience in its entirety by turning to the Kabbalah, just as the Jewish feminist movement is doing by proudly claiming all of that imagery about the Shekhinah as an example for what modernity can be. All of this, I think, is part of a larger movement which began in Europe in the middle of the 19th century and which flourishes even now, a kind of reevaluation, a romanticization of what religion should be and can be, a kind of contra-enlightenment, a kind of contrapositivism, a kind of despair with science and rationality and everything that it's brought, an attempt to find something more significant, meaningful to life than what the rationalizing scientific mind can bring to us. There's been a dramatic recovery of romantic religion, of a hunger and an appetite for the depths of human experience, exploring deep to find the wealth of symbols which the Kabbalah once upon a time talked about in its arcane reading of the Bible. There is a sort of neo-Hasidism afoot in the late 20th century, a kind of neo-Hasidism that takes the interest in the human psyche and the tzaddik's care of the human psyche and transforms it into a path that all Jews and other religious people can find useful for themselves as well. I'm thinking not of the Zionist ideologues and ideologists who fashioned and were the architects of the renewal of Jewish national life. I'm not thinking of the Jewish liberal thinkers who brought Judaism in line with 20th century thinking, but I'm thinking of authors, favorite authors like Martin Buber, well-known and well-read, and other people like Abraham Joshua Heschel, whose books like God in Search of Man are a reworking of the Kabbalist tradition for modern people in search of meaning. Even the title of Abraham Joshua Heschel's book, God in Search of Man, more or less indicates what he was able to distill from the thousand-year tradition of Jewish mysticism for the needs of modern people. Ordinary religion was androcentric, anthropocentric. It's what we need to get out of religion. It's our dependence on God. What Heschel taught inspired by the Kabbalah and by the Hasidism out of which he emerged, is that as much as humans need God, God is in search of human beings too. And Heschel's theology is a theology of discovering in reality all of the calling cards left by divine asking us to respond to an invitation. The response to that invitation will yank us out of our positivism and our narrow-mindedness and lead us to higher reaches of religious and spiritual satisfaction and sensitivity to the interconnectedness of all things. Neo-Hasidism flourishes in many, many different forms and in many different places. Heschel's set of books is one. Arthur Green at Brandeis University is writing one article and one pamphlet after another with titles like New Directions in Jewish Theology in America or Judaism for the Postmodern Era, where people like Arthur Green are laying out what modern Jews can find in the Jewish mystical and Hasidic tradition to nourish their souls, to uplift their spirits, to discover what more there is to life than the narrowness of our everyday existence. So there's a neo-Hasidic movement that flourished and flourishes now in late 20th century America, a kind of postmodern Jewish theology that draws its inspiration primarily from the Hasidic and Kabbalistic tradition. Much as many other Westerners have turned their interest to the East, to Hinduism and Buddhism, to find something satisfying to their souls, so many Jews who in the middle of the 50s and the 60s were turning to Hinduism and Buddhism too, are now rediscovering in their own roots metaphors, poems, stimulations to their own imagination, guidelines for meditation, which are authentically Jewish for them, and which are satisfying their deep needs in a kind of postmodern, non-scientific, non-positivistic fashion. Finally, there are other people who are interested in Jewish mysticism too. Our modern interests in literature and in the life of the imagination lead us to go back to these old texts to see how they worked their magic. Sometimes the magic is done with a very pragmatic aim, like understanding the wonderful and enigmatic puzzles by people like Franz Kafka, whose parables and stories bear an uncanny resemblance to the kind of storytelling and parables rendered by the Hasidim, in particular one of the Hasidic masters, Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav. Those who are interested in modern European literature in the form of Kafka and in his mysteries and parables might do well to consult the sources of Jewish mysticism and how it tells its stories in order to capture more than reality is allowed to be captured in our ordinary means, to understand not only Kafka's origins, but Kafka's way of thinking. Only by storytelling, only by parables, only by metaphors, only by imagination, only by thinking ourselves into other worlds, to envision other possibilities, is human life going to be much more possible for us. We've used up a lot of the old ways of thinking and moving, and perhaps the mystical traditions offer something that will not only clarify Kafka's way of thinking, but Kafka's stories themselves as an invitation to our way of doing things. As we come more or less to the end of these 10 lectures, I thought it most appropriate then to end with a parable. A parable that might in some way capture what Jewish mysticism tried to do for the Jewish people and its culture throughout its history from the Middle Ages and on. Perhaps the parable also has something to tell us about what the Sabbateans thought Shabtai Tzvi was doing when he became one of the first modern Jews, behaving externally like everyone else, but internally holding on to some sense of a messianic identity. Perhaps the parable, too, tells the secret of the Hasidim, who understood how their charismatic tzaddikim succeeded in doing in what nothing else was able to do in saving the Jewish soul. And perhaps the parable might have some other meanings which we couldn't exhaust if we stood here from now till doomsday. Here is the parable. It might help interpret Kafka. It might summarize neatly the course of lectures on Jewish mysticism. It's the tale of the descent of the tzaddik, trying to explain why it is that a divine soul, or even divinity itself, must take the forms that it takes down here in everyday, quotidian, ordinary existence. Why must the soul descend? And according to the good old Kabbalistic notions, Lurianic notions, before one can ascend, there is the need for descent. The soul must come down from heaven before it can revert. A king sent his only son away from the royal palace so that he might afterward yearn all the more for the table of his father. The first stage, alienation, divorce, losing one's place for the greater good of learning to yearn for the origin. A king sent his only son away from the royal palace so that he might afterward yearn all the more for the table of his father. Because of the son's foolishness, the parable continues, the prince mingled with the commoners and villagers and the strangers in the village, and he learned their ways, and after a time he forgot the pleasures of the royal table. The prince went native, so to speak, forgetting what his true origin was. In parable, the soul learns to go native, picking up the habits of the world down here as it's lived, forgetting where the soul comes from, what its true origin is, and what its destiny must be. The king, of course, was heartbroken, having lost his only son. And so the king sent one of his nobles after the prince to bring him back, but he failed. That prince didn't know the secret of how to turn the prince back to what his origins were, returning him to his father's house. The king sent another noble, and then another and another, but none succeeded. The prince remained in the village, having gone native, dressing like everyone else, forgetting where the prince had come from, forgetting the pleasures of his father's table. But finally, at last, one of the king's nobles discovered the secret of how to establish a relationship, some communion with the prince, who had left the father and forgot the father's ways. This last noble removed his elegant clothing and put on plain clothes, just like those of the villagers, in order that he might have something in common with the prince and enter into conversation with him. Having changed his clothes, having gone native in order to establish a relationship, the noble finally succeeded, and he returned the prince to his father. One wonders whether that parable can't be a parable for Jewish mysticism, and why it was so attractive to Jews down through the ages, and why at other times and in other places it had no meaning at all. Perhaps at the late 20th century, for large numbers of Jews and people in general, the traditional forms of 19th and 20th century thought no longer are enough to awaken our soul, to enliven our imagination, and to give us new ways of going. Perhaps all of us have forgotten who we are and what we can aspire to. For one reason or another, people are interested in Jewish mysticism and in the Kabbalistic tradition, in strange ways of reading the Bible, counting words, counting letters, making equivalences between words, finding underlined unities between one thing or another. For one reason or another, people are interested in hearing about strange books written in the 4th to the 6th century, the Sefer Yetzirah, which describes God's way of creating the world in 32 paths of wisdom, 10 mystical, ineffable sefirot, and the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Studying the secrets of the Hebrew alphabet in order to understand why it is that there are 7 continents and 7 openings on the head of the human being and 7 days in the week. Is this really a home, a universe where we are at home? For one reason or another, we become extraordinarily interested in people like Abraham Abulafia and his techniques for altering states of consciousness. Some people alter their consciousness by drink, some people by drugs, other people by running, other people by all sorts of things. But Abulafia seems to have his devotees too. The one who teaches us that to learn to manipulate language and numbers is to discover links between things that make the things themselves less important than the relationships, and less important than the mind that establishes and invites them and creates them and discovers them. For one reason or another, all of the things that modernity has tried to get us back to who we really are have failed. But at the end of the 20th century, here we are interested in many, many strange things. And we're interested in a Jewish mystical tradition, which I think in these lectures I have tried to dress in a way familiar to all of us, removing some of its mysteries, but trying to make as much of it as familiar as possible, trying to establish something in common between us and that mystical tradition, so that mystical tradition will not only become more accessible and understandable to us, because as good humanists, we want nothing human to be alien, but perhaps because the mystical tradition can do something for us which it did for Judaism in its hours of need. Between the 12th and the 16th century, it fed the imagination and held philosophy at bay while it flirted with philosophy's ideas. After the 16th century, it inspired people with the confidence that what they do really does make a difference. And that's perhaps the lesson that we all want to hear, that we're significant in some way, that if not God, at least our neighbors and our country and our nation and our planet all depends on what we do. I don't know anywhere where all of these ideas are so dramatically developed in such ambiguous, wonderful, inspiring way than in the imagery and ideas and myths of the Kabbalah. That may be one of the reasons why, at the end of the 20th century, people want to listen to lectures on Jewish mysticism in a way that at the end of the 19th century, in Mr. Gratz's time, audiences ran from them as fast as they possibly could. In the beginning, I said that the historian is interested in change and in diversity and in interactivity. Jewish mysticism has had its phases, and it's had its changes, and it's had its evolution, and it's had its variety of interactions with different times and different places. The final chapters of Jewish mysticism are not yet written. What will happen from this point on remains to be seen. I've only tried to describe. I've been a zookeeper trying to display the animals in as natural a habitat as I possibly could. What happens after we all go home, having seen the animals in the zoo in their natural habitat? What we make of all of that, I'm not sure. That remains for the next generation to say. We've detached Jewish mysticism from its natural setting, the way art has been detached from churches and altars, and the way music has been detached from its liturgical setting in churches too. And we've displayed them here the way art is displayed on the walls of a museum or listen to music in the halls of a concert hall. It may have been an interesting experience. One hopes that it was also useful. What will come of it eventually, we'll only find out after much time has passed and the magic of Jewish metaphysical imagination has worked its magic on us as well.